Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Rest is History, where today we are going off with a bang because we are talking about Pompeii, Herculaneum, Vesuvius, the works. I'm Tom Holland and with me is my co-conspirator Dominic Sandbrook. And Dominic, thank you very, very much for allowing me to do Pompeii. It's really kind of you.
You don't dare to face me on your own, do you, Tom?
That's true. And I'm very, very happy to announce that we have a very special guest with us today. Sophie Hay, who is an archaeologist who's worked at Pompeii and the adjoining areas for 25 years, runs the Pompeii social media accounts, is just about to start a book on women archaeologists who worked at Pompeii. So there couldn't be anyone better to talk about the site. Sophie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Hello. Well, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, Sophie.
So, obviously, I'm terribly excited to be doing one on Pompeii.
Me too, Tom. Me too.
I think it would only be fair to hand over to Dominic to ask the first question, because otherwise I'm just going to kind of explode with excitement.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Well, Sophie, I went to Pompeii on honeymoon in 2007.
Good choice.
Along with, you know, a billion other people. And it's a kind of weird place, isn't it? Because it's both an archaeological site where you sort of dig for historical artifacts and for insights into history, but it's also basically the Roman Disney World, right? I mean, there's a kind of tension there, isn't there? It's a sort of strange, must be a weird thing for you, for whom it's work. And most people just go on a day trip and they're interested in the gift shop and in, you know, sunshades and Coke and all this sort of stuff. So does that seem kind of weird to you to be working amidst all that?
It's interesting. I mean, when I was working there, I was mainly in a part where the tourists couldn't be. So I was kind of, you know, shielded from all of that. But I did work in the Forum at one point, and that it was like being a sort of museum exhibit yourself. Tourists coming up, yeah, saying, have you found any dinosaurs yet, etc. and I must be in about 6 billion people's photograph albums because everyone was taking photographs. So yeah, that kind of, when it was really in my face, it was weird. It also, work was very slow because you were just answering questions. But it's also great because you know that what you're doing matters and means something to, yeah, so many people. So there's a kind of that side of it I adore. I just love people's fascination, continual sort of questions about site and what we're doing. So yeah,
it doesn't make you uneasy that it's become a kind of a sort of, well, you know, how many coachloads of American, Chinese and British tourists go to Pompeii every year and sort of troop round and then troop off again?
Yeah, no, that bit always makes me sad because I just think they do. They go to three main things. They see the Forum, they see the brothel, they laugh in the brothel, then they go and see one house, and then they're back on their coach and they go off to, you know, have a nice lunch somewhere.
Yeah.
It does, because I just feel like they haven't had the most of it. But, you know, at the same time, there are people who stay there for days on end and, you know, really try and embrace everything. So
Sophie, you hinted at the fact that obviously lots of it is open to the public, but also quite a lot isn't, and even more hasn't even been excavated.
Yeah.
And one of the excitements that's going on at the moment is that there's a kind of a surge of fresh excavations. So can you just give us a sense of how much remains to be opened and what the most exciting recent discoveries have been?
Well, what remains to be opened is really hard to say because it changes every 5 minutes. As they're doing conservation, they open up a new house, but then they close another one so that it kind of gets a break from tourists trooping in and out with their backpacks, scratching along the frescoes and things. So it's kind of always in kind of flux, the site. And some are only open in the morning. Some buildings are only open in the afternoon. So they're trying to kind of stagger it a bit just to kind of help. But in terms of what hasn't been excavated at all, it's about one third of the town. So it's still a huge amount that hasn't been excavated. And on the top of that, there's sort of farms growing tomatoes, which I used to go and steal for my sandwiches, which is why I know they're up there.
Yeah, and of course, because famously, the reason why the soil is so fertile is because it's volcanic.
Exactly.
So in a sense, it's kind of devil's bargain, isn't there? So I guess we should, having just kind of vaguely sketched out what you can see and what the state of play is now, we should talk briefly about how it is that Pompeii and Herculaneum have been preserved, because it's probably the most famous volcanic explosion in history, isn't it?
I would go with that. The whole eruption took sort of 24 hours, I think, in total. So it was kind of a bit of a slow burner, which is why, you know, we find, I think, so many people still there, because people kept thinking, we'll be okay. But the first thing they saw really was this kind of column of smoke coming and a sort of cloud of gas coming out of the mountain. And we know about this because Pliny the Younger, who was the nephew of Pliny the Elder, was actually writing about this at the time. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a clue. So we have a really nice eyewitness account of this eruption. This column of ash and gases rose up to about, I think it was about 30 kilometres up into the air. And then collapsed on itself. And that's when we kind of get all the pumice stone raining down, starting to cover the city. But this takes so long. I mean, there's sort of hours of this that people are kind of, well, maybe we'll be all right. And then, you know, as it builds up in the town and the material kind of gradually grabs
up. Had this happened before? So in other words,
I mean, in terms, yes.
So people, when they thought it's probably going to go away or it'll be a bit of a pain, but we'll get over it, they weren't being completely demented.
The previous one was sort of nearly 2,000 years beforehand. So
but the volcano must have rumbled and thrown stuff.
Yeah, they had no concept of an eruption. They had concepts of earthquakes. They had a lot of earthquakes and they were well aware that, you know, they were in an unstable area, but they had no clue, not an inkling as to the idea of an eruption. And even Pliny the Elder, who is Mr. sort of natural history, he didn't really even think that Vesuvius was a volcano anyway. So, I mean, you know, not even the people in the know knew. So
Pliny gets it wrong, Sean.
Exactly, there's the headline.
What did he think it was? Just a mountain with a lot of smoke?
It's there in the names, isn't it? Because the story is that Hercules, the great hero, who I'm sure we've talked about before, Dominic, on our many just podcasts about Greek mythology, the story is that he comes to Italy and the giants are rebellious against the gods, and so he shoves them underneath Vesuvius. And so the idea is that they're kind of twitching and shaking and convulsing
in their
chains, generates the earthquake.
Yeah.
And Heracles gives his name to Herculaneum, and he's supposed to have had a victory procession, which in Greek is Pompeii, which is supposedly where the name Pompeii comes from. So there must have been some kind of idea that potentially there was danger. But as you say, I mean, no idea about
it's
volcano.
A long stretch from, you know, the earth shaking a bit to...
Yeah. And people live in earthquake zones now, don't they? I mean, people live in LA or Istanbul or...
Exactly. Yeah. And they live under volcanoes now too. And, you know, it was when I lived there, I lived there solidly for 4 years. So I got to know, you know, the locals. And it was a real split camp on whether people would stay in the city during an eruption or not. And of course, some of them had actually lived through the last eruption, which was in 1944. So they kind of knew, you know, and they know that there was sort of potential disaster, but they weren't prepared to leave. That was their home, you know, that was where they were going to stay. And then I found some friends who were on a motorbike and getting the hell out. And that's, you know, that's what I, those are the friends I stuck with.
And give us some sense, Sophie, of the sort of size and importance of Pompeii before the eruption happened. So is it, it's not that far from, I mean, Naples was a presumably a bigger place then, was it? Neapolis?
Yeah, Neapolis, exactly.
And was it a sort of, was it a resort town, a market town?
It's more of a port town. So Herculaneum is more the kind of resort. Yeah. And Pompeii was very much a kind of working town. But it's interesting because people always say, well, Pompeii is a kind of bog standard town. It's like, I can't remember who said it, but someone said it.
Reading, isn't it?
So, exactly. Something like that. Saffron Walden, I think it's been compared to. But I don't really think it is. I mean, I've travelled quite extensively around the Roman Empire, and I think it's actually, on its own, it's quite an astounding place. The level of craftsmanship, the sort of the organisation of the place. I think it's, it was actually quite a special place, but it was, the main hub of it was a port town.
And it's old, isn't it? I mean, it's an old place. It's kind of long precedes the Romans, precedes the Greeks. You've got these people called Oscans who are settling there. And then, well, actually, Sophie, you and I know this because Sulla, the terrifying Republican general who is the first to march on Rome, the reason he has these armies is because the Italians have kind of risen in revolt against Roman rule. And it's Sulla who essentially besieges and storms Pompeii. And the crater marks on the walls left by his catapults can still be seen. And the last time you took me to Pompeii, you pointed them out to me, so it's an absolute highlight. And
there is one catapult that still exists. They found it just, I mean, it does look like a bomb, really. That was going to do some damage.
Kind of amazing sight. And then Sulla, his troops get planted there and it becomes a colony. So in a sense, you know, within kind of, you know, less than two centuries by the time of the destruction, it's been colonized by the Romans. It's been stormed by the Romans. It's been colonized by the Romans. And so it is a kind of hybrid place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is what aggravates my little, you know, one of my many hills that I'll go and die on, is that people say it's a time capsule, frozen in time. I mean, well, you can't really say frozen when it's just undergone an eruption, but still. but this kind of time capsule thing, as if, you know, it's preserving something absolutely, you know, at a specific time. It's really kind of annoys me because it has got this history that goes back to the sort of 6th century BC. And the whole city is a kind of palimpsest of all of this. It's you know, as most cities are, they're sort of, you know, there's older bits, there's newer bits, and it doesn't really fit in that sort of time capsule moment for me at all.
So it's not a particular so frozen history. Moment of kind of Romanness.
Absolutely not. No, not to me.
And how many of the people there would have been? I mean, how many of the people would everybody there have considered themselves Romans?
More or less, yeah.
So it wasn't a sort of a melting pot, as it were.
Well, I mean, it is, but then, you know, to be a Roman citizen, you were a Roman citizen whether you came from Syria
right.
or wherever. So in that sense, yes. I mean, then there's obviously a lot of slaves who were not considered citizens as such. So it is still a melting pot, but the citizens are...
Famously, there's the Indian goddess, isn't there, who is conventionally called Lakshmi, the statue of the Indian goddess that's in the Naples Archaeological Museum.
Yes.
I don't think it is Lakshmi. I think
no, it's not. It's the other one.
I remember being told off.
No, I know.
Traditionally, that's what she's called.
It's the other one, but the name escapes.
But
me.
I mean,
that
is also the fascination of it, isn't it? That you get the sense of peoples who lived there who don't normally show up in the kind of the historical records, the grand sweep, and so it is kind of possible to tell the stories of the kinds of class of people who otherwise we might not be able to. And I think that's something that you're particularly interested in, isn't it?
Yeah, no, for me, and I think, you know, it's become really popular more recently, is to edge away from the emperors and the main civic buildings. You know, we know about temples, we know about basilica and all of that stuff, but Pompeii gives you, you know, amazing opportunity to see everyday life and the person who owns a bar, the person who runs a laundrette, and then the sort of the invisible slaves kind of come to life as well, because you can actually start imagining them, you know, at work. They don't leave many traces behind, but you can suddenly see this city is only going to function with, you know, an engine room type thing of slaves behind it. And I think that's what Pompeii gives me is suddenly this sort of huge light is cast on those members of society that don't normally kind of get into the history books.
So if, let me ask you this question. So as a modern historian, when I go to a lot of these sites, there's always this slight element of being underwhelmed because there's a pile of stones. So when I drag my son and I say, there's this most amazing...
You're that guy Roman, on TripAdvisor.
It's this most amazing Roman site. He often says, is there actually a wall or is it really just a line of stones?
There's some sort of
degree of truth in that, is that you go to these sites and you're hoping to get into the Roman world and it is just buildings. But Pompeii is obviously different because the one thing that everybody gets from Pompeii are the plaster casts of the people fleeing the explosion. So you see effectively you see the people, but you see them frozen or rather kind of, I guess, baked in the moment of agony, in the moment of their death. And at what point does that sort of cross a bit of a line? I mean, you wouldn't do that in any sort of recent natural disaster. You wouldn't say, oh, let's go and look at all the corpses of the people who died. So how do you kind of feel about that? Do you think it's, I mean, obviously, you know, the visitors love it, but do you feel it's okay?
I sort of sit on a bit of a fence on that. I think ethically, I feel it is a bit sort of voyeuristic and it makes me a little bit uncomfortable, but at the same time, it has given us, and it's given Pompeii that real sort of visceral sense of what happened. And the city was populated and they did suffer. And I think without them being cast and just seeing, you know, some bones, I don't think it has that same power. And as archaeologists and tourists, we always feel we need that connection or to relate to something to better understand it. And I think that's what they provide for me anyway.
There are dogs and
I know there's a pig. There's a pig.
Kind of amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No.
So Sophie, one thing I wonder about that The way that these they're not bodies, are they? I mean, the plaster casts, the kind of the gaps that these incinerated people had left. There seems to be a huge temptation to impose narratives and stories onto them. So it can be kind of quite fun. There was this kind of famous, was it last year? There was a picture of a body with a rock that had fallen on it that everyone found very funny. But you also get stories about women going to see gladiators and all this kind of stuff. Now, that is a kind of romantic projection, isn't it? Most of these. I mean, the evidence for these stories, when you look at them closely, almost always tends to kind of slightly fall to pieces.
Yes, well, that kind of goes back to us always trying to relate and to make them something that we understand or give them a story so that we feel emotionally attached. And yes, there's the cast of the pregnant woman, or is it just a bit of her clothing that's ridden up and has given her a bulge? And, you know, we're not sure. I think it's a really natural sort of idea for us to try and make these stories. And then, yes, as you say, later on, you know, they scan the cast and they find out that actually that woman was a man or the other way around. I think there was one that was supposed to be, it was called the Moor, and it turned out to be a local lad of 14 or something who just happened to be a bit bigger framed. So yes, they did get unraveled, but at the same time, it's so natural. And I mean, I do it every day on site. You know, I would make up little stories about my barman because it kind of helps kind of tick it along.
But equally, not to be a party pooper. There are amazing stories that you can extrapolate, perhaps not from the bodies, but from the graffiti and from the so on. So just give a couple of your favourite examples of that.
I think one of my favourites is this man called Gaius Alius Nigidius Maius. And I like him because he kind of embodies to me how we find out about these people in Pompeii. We don't go into their houses and rummage through their sort of desk drawers and find a whole load of documents that tell us exactly what he was doing on this day or whatever. You know, we don't have that in Pompeii. And I think people think that that's how it works is, you know, you find the house of someone and you automatically know what they're all up to. And this guy who they discovered his house in 1810, I think. So very early on in the beginning of the excavations. And they found his name painted on the wall and said, this is my property and I want to let it out. So see my slave Primus about, you know, renting it. And that's all we knew about him. Then it kind of transpired that his family, who had adopted him, was very rich because they've got tombs outside the town. And then about 100 years later, you know, on the other side of Pompeii, excavation is continuing, and they find some painted notices on the wall which tell us that Nigidius Maius is in charge of organising the amphitheatre games. So we suddenly get, you know, a flashback 100 years later to sort of, you know, oh, this guy, yes, I remember him from over there. And then we find out that he was organising games probably during the ban, when Nero banned the games from AD 59, because he starts putting on games, but they don't have gladiators in them because they're banned, because there was a riot and Nero got cross. And then spool forward to, I think it was about 2018. So another 100 years passes, and they find a tomb in the south of the city, and they find a huge long inscription. Everyone gets very excited, except there's no name on it. So it's still kind of a blank. But in the inscription, they've got details of this huge banquet that's put on it's nearly 7,000 people he puts a banquet on for. But it also says he was the organizer of the games during the ban of Nero. So it's probably his tomb. And this whole inscription is a bit sort of like the Res Gestae type thing. It's sort of what I did when I was alive and what I accomplished and how great I am. So then we've suddenly got a biography of this man. But this has taken 200 years to piece together from three different places in town. And I just think, you know, his life is, he was very important in the town. He had the highest office, the ranking office that you could have. But yeah, that's the process is really slow. And I think that he embodies it for me. And I just kind of love that fragmentary sticking jigsaw pieces together.
So Dom, he's kind of Barry Hearn.
Yes, or indeed Donald Trump. That's a nice thought, no, isn't it?
He put games on free. He was nice. He was a nice guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's never a free lunch.
No. There's a quid pro quo, isn't there? Sophie, you've already outed me as the man on TripAdvisor who complains about a pile of stones, I might as well go all in.
Okay.
The other thing that people take away from Pompeii that everybody knows about is the erotic art. Right. I mean, that's what a lot of tourists come to see. They come to see, they expect to see mosaics of sort of people, you know, behaving in a debauched way.
Yes.
Now, my question is sort of twofold. Is that, have we exaggerated that, or was that kind of the norm? And if it was the norm and people had that stuff in their kind of dining room, does that tell us that the Romans were completely unlike us? And their sort of moral standards and everything were utterly different? Or am I exaggerating and overplaying that?
No, I think you're spot on. I think it is really prevalent. And when they first started excavating in the mid-18th century, the excavators were horrified to find that there were phalluses sort of transcended every class in Pompeii. It wasn't just, right, you know, in the elite, or it wasn't just the, you know, the naughty little sort of bar owners and things like that. It pervaded all sort of society. And they were absolutely horrified, and they took all of the material away and hid it in a museum in the palace at Portici, because they just didn't want people to know that, you know, the Romans were so unlike, I mean, I say us, I mean, this is already 50 years ago. And that carried on, you know, hiding this stuff. And in fact, which it then became the secret museum in Naples, which only opened to the public in 2000. That's when it was kind of deemed okay. So, I mean, it's taken us quite a long time to get to grips with the pornography.
As it were.
Yes. No pun intended. In fact, I went to the British Library. I probably shouldn't name and shame them, but I went to the British Library to look at one of the erotic art books of Pompeii. And it was under sort of special handling label or something. And I had to go to a desk where I wasn't allowed to take photographs. It had, you know, a big sort of stickers on it saying don't take photos. And it was literally just a coffee table book of the frescoes that we see on the internet all the time. But I just thought this is quite hilarious that still, you know, in 2019, whenever it was, that it was still under this kind of ban. But no, it was everywhere. And I think they did. Kind of,
so give me some sense. Okay. So basically, if you grew up in Pompeii, or indeed any Roman town in that time, you were surrounded by this stuff all the time, right? From childhood to, you know, it wasn't something that little Johnny and great aunt Marjorie don't get to see because they're the wrong age and it's not appropriate. It's always appropriate. Was that the kind of?
I think there were slight boundaries. I mean, there's lots of context for sort of rude bits and pieces. Obviously you've got the brothel, which, you know, kids probably wouldn't be going to. But inside private houses, you know, the erotic pictures are mainly in the more private areas, although there's some are in the sort of the atrium, which is where everyone can go. But then you've got things like the plaques with penises on for sort of good luck. So that has a completely different sort of idea about it, and that was seen by everybody. They were on street corners, they're above your door, they were on wind chimes, lamps. I mean, you would see a phallic symbol even as a child, absolutely.
I mean, I find Pompeii quite oppressive for that reason, because it's tempting to fight, go, you know, huge phalluses everywhere.
Yeah,
but I mean, actually children would have been sexually abused in houses and in brothels. I mean, they were, you know, they were perfectly legitimate. And what I feel when you go to Pompeii and you look at the spaces in which the slaves were obliged to live, and you know that they are kind of free game for whoever is free, whoever owns them. And you feel how horrendous it must have been to be owned, to be kind of subject to the kind of sustained sexual abuse that clearly is providing the sexual economy of Pompeii with its foundations. And so I think that one of the tensions in going to Pompeii is that it is marketed as something where you can see how the Romans really lived. And the implication is, oh, look, they were just like us. But actually, I think if you look more deeply, you find they weren't like us at all. It was kind of terrifyingly different. On which note, I think perhaps we should go for a break, and when we come back,
I thought you were going to plug your book there, Tom. That was the obvious place.
I was about to. And I could sense the disappointment unspoken coming at me down the line. So no, I'm not going to plug my book, which is available from all good bookshops. Let's go for a break, and when we come back, maybe I can plug it then.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
They used to say, go west. What they meant was go forward. Find your own way. Make something out of nothing. It can be tempting to take it easy, but discovery doesn't wait. So this summer, see what it means to make the most of dawn, dusk, and every minute in between. The truth lies west. Discover yours at TravelWyoming.com.
Welcome back to my show, The Rest is History, with my guests, Tom Holland and... sorry, I couldn't do that without laughing at that. My guest, Tom Holland and Dr. Sophie Hay, who's here to talk about Pompeii. We have a ton of questions, Tom, from...
We do.
...people on Twitter. I'm going to kick off with Mark Woodhouse. He says... He just wants to cut to the chase, basically. He says he wants to know, what is the most significant find from the recent excavations, and what do you reckon... is there? What is left? What's waiting to be dug up, Sophie?
So, the new excavations have been absolutely, just mind-boggling to me. And I'm quite used to all of, you know, the things that are found in Pompeii, but I have been as googly-eyed as everybody else watching these things kind of appear out of the ground. And there should be some kind of caveat saying that why these excavations took place, because I think people are just believing that they're going ahead digging without conserving what they've got. And in fact, this is all part of a bigger project that was given EU funding to basically make the sides of the excavation stable. So it's a conservation project, but it's got an element as they kind of step back the side of the excavation, they are actually digging in houses. But yeah, no, absolutely stunning. And I do actually think that the most recent find of the bar is probably one of the most important, because it takes us beyond what we knew before, whereas a lot of the other things, although they're stunning.
And why does it do that, Sophie? Because of the material found, the food that was found actually in the pots?
Yeah, no, absolutely. For the first time, and they're quite right in saying that, we can, you know, dig something absolutely properly, and they can throw technology at it. They've got the zoo archaeologists, they've got archaeobotanists looking at the remains inside the pot. So the fact that they found a duck bone inside the pot, it's actually the first time that we've got a bone in a pot in a bar in Pompeii. Food has been found in these kind of sunken ceramic vessels that are kind of encased within the bar. And all the previous ones that we know of, or any evidence we've had, is always dried food. So we've always had this thing that they were serving dried food, and suddenly we get shifted completely off, and we suddenly think, oh, actually they were producing hot food, and it was being stored in these pots. And we have, I think there was a pork and fish dish, so probably the first surf and turf dish that there was in
that
one pot.
Disgusting.
Well, the next pork pot is even worse. You'd go and get pork and fish rather than snails, fish and sheep soup or something.
Snails, fish and what?
Sheep.
And sheep.
Sheep, yeah.
Yeah. So they were found in another pot. Fish gut sauce.
Exactly.
Garum. Is that garum? So,
yeah. Well, that's all right, actually. That's more like soy sauce. So we can kind of let the garum slide off. But snail soup is not much for me.
I mean, important to emphasize as well that it's not just Pompeii, because there's also Herculaneum, which
is
the modern town of, is built right on top of it. And I think I'm right in remembering that the house of the local mafia boss is over a crucial section of it that they want to dig up. So that's not going to happen. And then, of course, there's the famous Villa of Papyri, isn't there?
Exactly,
The tantalising possibility.
Yeah, no, when I worked there, they had demolished a whole series of houses, and there was this sort of little island sticking up, and in it was the mafia boss under house arrest, watching us doing our work. So
the Roman patterns of patronage last into the 21st century.
Exactly.
Okay, well, here's the big question. Uh-oh. It's from Neil Page. Are we any closer in getting consensus on a confirmed date for when Vesuvius erupted? Okay, and Dominic, as a historian of modern Britain, I'm sure this embodies all your frustrations with ancient history, that we don't even know.
Don't even know when it happened.
No,
come on, get a grip of yourself.
So, Sophie, are you able to give us
in a
nutshell, yes, what the positions are?
Okay, so yes, Pliny the Younger writing his, we've only got medieval copies of his writing. So he wrote these letters, and he put in the date of the eruption that it happened. Thank you very much. Except the scribes, so I don't blame Pliny, I blame the later scribes. They couldn't quite read it. It was in a bit of, you know, tattery state or something. And so they just basically all made up different dates and inserted them. So we have the 24th of August, but we also have 30th of November or something, and something in October, and one in December, I think. So, but the one that the sort of the copy of the letter that's the best preserved is the one that's got the 24th of August. So that has basically become canon, and that's the one that's bounded around. Then you kind of look at the archaeology, and it kind of doesn't quite fit for the 24th of August. So the main archaeological evidence against August is pomegranates. And I'm definitely team pomegranate. The fact you've got ripened pomegranates means it has to have been later in autumn. So they don't ripen and get eaten until end of September. So pomegranates are one. Then there's some really nice stuff actually from grapes, because obviously you harvest grapes sort of October mm-hmm. time. And when one of the wine pressing rooms in Pompeii was being dug, they found that kind of sludge still on the floor from all the debris from wine pressing. And that wouldn't have been there in August. I mean, one would hope they'd have cleaned it up by then.
So, yes. Do you have a sense of, has the consensus swung now? I mean, these things take time, don't they? It's like moving an oil tanker. But do you think that it is a majority opinion now that it was in the autumn?
I think we'd all like to, say that is the case, but people will still refer to the 24th of August. And then we had that graffito in the new excavations, in fact. So that's another really important thing.
So what's that say?
It's written in charcoal, and annoyingly, it has a date of the 17th of October. So everyone got super excited saying, well, you can't write 17th of October if it's, if it was all up in smoke in August. But of course, there's no date. There's no year date.
Conceivably also be writing, I'll see you next month on.
Indeed. It could have been, yes. So we have all these like little tantalizing glimpses. Right. There was a coin as well that came up, which everyone said this could only have been minted after the 24th of August. And it was found in a context that was completely safe, that there was no evidence of tampering. And yet then it went to the British Museum, this coin got looked at, and they said, well, a bit that kind of gives you that sort of honorific title for Titus is actually really worn and you can't quite read it.
This is why you want to stick with Harold Wilson. You don't get this kind of nonsense. Tony Benn's diaries.
We don't even know the date of the big earthquake either. There's a huge earthquake and there's debate over that as well. We have two salient dates in Pompeii and we don't know which is which.
That brilliant kind of freeze showing all the buildings tilting and toppling and things.
Exactly. But 62, 63, who knows?
Dominic, do we have another question?
Yeah, we do. Let me ask a question from Nathan. Nathan's got a very good question, actually. He's asking about the rediscovery of Pompeii and what people knew about it beforehand. So in other words, had Pompeii completely been forgotten? Was the kind of local law that survived through all the centuries that said there is something there that is covered, there was this terrible tragedy, did sort of folk tales persist, or was this a sort of complete bolt from the blue when people started to uncover it?
Well, the Bourbons, who were digging it in 1748, would want you to believe that it was a complete bolt out of the blue and look at them, look what they discovered. Whereas actually, in reality, it was known about the whole time, pretty much, I would say.
Really?
Yeah.
So people have grown up for generations knowing that this
so
stuff...
So it appears on a map that's 3rd, 4th century AD, and it's labelled on the Peutinger map, so it's a map of Italy, and it's labelled as Pompeii there, as is Herculaneum, as is Aplontis, as is Stabiae.
Wow.
And then it becomes sort of in the medieval period, it becomes known as La Civita. So it's a mound, it's still covered. And I mean, there's debate as to whether things were popping out or not in terms of buildings. But La Civita means the settlement. So it's kind of understood that there's something still under there. And if you ploughing the ground all the time, because again, fertile soil, you things would pop out and bits of marble would come out. And so they did know all along. It's just that it wasn't interesting to them.
There's Sannazzaro, isn't it? The Neapolitan poet writing at the beginning of the 16th century his poem Arcadia.
Yes, exactly.
He kind of says, there are cities and towns and villas and things.
In 1594 said, in 1594 they started digging a tunnel through Pompeii for a canal. And so they kept hitting, as they were digging through the mound, they kept hitting walls. And they sort of flagged it up and went, I think we're hitting something. And the people in charge were like, well, don't worry about it, keep going. Because it basically didn't adhere to the kind of the ideology of the Inquisition, which was kind of that period. And any kind of reference to the past was kind of politically incorrect.
Sophie, I wanted to quiz you a bit on that. You said that they didn't care about it. They weren't interested. Can that really be true? Are you telling me that all these people just genuinely weren't, they didn't care?
Well, there wasn't that, I don't think there was that sort of fever for, I mean, to me, Pompeii is always a very political thing. It's used for propaganda. It's used by the Bourbons to promote themselves. It's used by Napoleon. It's used by Mussolini. You know, it's used during the period of unification of Italy, you know, to say who we are, what we are as people. You know, it's always had a political edge. So without that political edge, there's kind of no real...
Not even antiquarianism.
I don't think it was too early for right. collecting a statue, basically. Yeah. I mean, that's my sort of hold on this.
I think there's some evidence, isn't there, in the 16th and 17th century that people are kind of starting to ferret. I mean, I think it's kind of towards the end of the 17th century that somebody finds an inscription with Pompeii on it, so that they then know that it's...
Well, they think it's at that Pompeii. Point... Well, no, at that point, they think it's the Villa of Pompey the Great. So they confuse it and they're like, well, it's not as great.
And then they cross-reference and
exactly. And so, no, there is sort of interest amongst some, but it's not a big explosion of we've got to have the statuary and everything that happens... I mean, in Herculaneum, it starts beforehand. It starts at the beginning of the 18th century when a guy sinks his well over the theatre in Herculaneum and pulls out marble. And then there's an Austrian prince who decides, well, I'm building a villa. I'd quite like that marble on my walls. Thanks. So he starts the sort of the process, and then it kind of gets exploded when Charles Bourbon kind of comes into town and says, yes, let's have all this stuff, and builds a museum and the rest of it.
And then Lady Hamilton's cuckold yes. husband.
Kicks in. Well, yes, he does a fair bit. Yeah. Yeah. He does a lot of work.
We've got a question. We've already kind of touched on it, but maybe we could just, as it were, flesh it out. It's from the aptly named Ennius. And he says, in the light of recent discoveries, what would the typical daily diet of a resident of Pompeii and Herculaneum be? And I suppose that depends on what class of person we talking about.
Actually, it's quite interesting. Our good friend Andrew Wallace Hadrill dug a sewer in Herculaneum, and the sewer goes underneath a range of houses and shops, and from, you know, very low class to slightly better. And he could see exactly what they were shitting out of each house. And in fact, the range of foods was just like you'd find, you know, in an elite house. They were having fresh fish. I mean, they live right on the coast, seashells, meats, different vegetables, and their diet is actually sort of the one thing that's the great unifier in these towns, I think, from this evidence. And then you've got all the frescoes of food, which kind of help us see what they were growing. I think it's to me that the Pompeians and Herculaneum people were sort of perpetually eating. So if they weren't growing it themselves in their gardens, which they did a lot, and we have good excavations to show us what kind of, you know, they had cabbages and garlic and things like that, and obviously vineyards. But then they had pictures of them on their walls, and then they, you know, they would go out and buy it, and then eventually they would eat it. But it's kind of, they're just constant, which is very Italian, actually. If you go to Italy now, if you're having a meal with an Italian, they'll be talking about the next meal. So
how many meals a day, Sophie, do they have?
I think they were having three. I think the main meal, I think, in the day was lunch, if I'm not mistaken.
I will always be grateful to you for taking me behind the scenes of the museum at Herculaneum and showing me the charred remains of all the figs and the grain. And amazing, amazing sight.
The dates. And the bread. Yeah, really amazing. Loaves of bread.
So
all of that evidence helps us know exactly what they're eating. But yeah, I think the Herculaneum evidence is excellent for kind of saying across the board that these people were all enjoying a kind of really good diet. They were on fertile land next to a bountiful sea. It's kind of perfect.
Well, this brings us perfectly to John Hawke's question. He wants to know about, he's obviously a sewerage consultant or some sort of waste disposal professional. He wants to know about street cleansing. Ooh. Was it dirty? Were people throwing their stuff out in the street? How many were there? He questions whether there were sewers. There appear to be little or no sewers, he says.
Pompeii does have a lack of sewers. I think there's one massive big one. But basically under the streets of Pompeii, there's none. They used for their poo, they basically used sort of soakaways. They just used the natural earth to kind of absorb.
Nice.
So, yeah, I know, smelly. So yes, no, there's one thing that I think a lot of people forget is the smell of Pompeii. And I think it would have been pretty rancid at times. In terms of cleaning the streets, there are laws about making sure that your property is clean outside, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't quite disgusting. And in fact, in the recent excavations, because, you know, they weren't just trying to get down to hard and fast archaeology in terms of roads and buildings, they were looking at all the sort of accumulations. They did find on a road a sort of a slew of shit, basically. And it kind of does show the state that some of these, you know, back streets might have been in. The main thoroughfares might have been really nice and clean and looked after, because that's where the aediles of the town were kind of passing through. But the back streets may have been worse. But in terms of cleaning the streets, they used nature. And because Pompeii's on a slope, when it rains, they had water towers and things collecting water during sort of drier seasons, but that would overflow and they would just let the water race down the street. And when it rains in Pompeii, if you're there now, the roads are like rivers. And then you suddenly realize why those little stepping stones are actually quite useful. So you can kind of avoid these torrents of water. So it kind of would have naturally cleaned itself, but people would have been involved. But yeah, it would have been a pretty smelly
place. Of course, the people would have been very smelly, wouldn't they? To us, they would seem, yeah.
Although they did, you know, they did enjoy their baths regularly.
But the bath.
A little oily smell to you.
Yes.
Wading around in other people's games. Yes.
Okay, this is the next question is from Ian McKinney, and it is something that we have touched on several times, but let's just try and nail it down. Realistically, is there likely to be any more completely new discoveries at Pompeii, or have we probably learned everything we're going to learn? So I guess by that he means, you know, some spectacular building, some amazing edifice. But of course, I mean, actually, in a way, what's most fascinating is the kind of the tiny details of graffiti or the, I mean,
exactly. Yeah,
the,
no,
the unexpected.
Unless they find the planning office, I'd like that for my work. Sort of how houses developed and things like that would be really useful. But no, absolutely, the key is in the detail. And these new excavations have provided a lot of confirmation of what we already knew, which is reassuring. But they keep adding like little details, so new graffiti or signs that say somebody's running for political office or something like that. So we are building a picture, but things like the bar that really change how we know about their diet or what was being eaten in these fast food places, which, I mean, I shouldn't call it fast food. It actually makes me a little queasy calling that, because we're labeling it as such. I just, but yeah, no, I think there's plenty to be found. I mean, one third of the city is still uncovered. There's still a lot out there, but I hope in a weird way, I don't want to see it in my lifetime.
Yeah. If you had a kind of dream discovery, Sophie, if there's one thing you wanted to find, a question that nags at you or a discovery, what would it be?
It would be the planning office. It would be how people, you know, if there was,
that's
such
not
a thing.
The answer I was expecting.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Something more romantic. I know, but this is what you get when you work there too long and you're obsessed by walls. You want to know, did they get permission to add to their houses and change their property boundaries?
You want to know if they got planning permission. That's genuinely the question that keeps you awake at night.
She should be writing the history of 1970s England.
I haven't got a very romantic notion on that, sorry.
So not the buried library.
Well, if it comes, if the planning office happens to be next to the library, then bingo.
Yeah, that would, everyone would be happy. I think we've covered a fair amount. Do you mind if I just crowbar in one thing that I carefully researched?
Yeah,
because I was asked a question. Is there any evidence for Christians having been in Pompeii? And I think it's interesting because it shows how, in a way, how difficult it is to kind of make sense of the process of archaeology. Because it turns out that there was an inscription that was found in 1862 that apparently has Christianos, so Christians, and it's conventionally translated as Bovio is listening to the Christians who are cruel haters, is how it's conventionally translated. But the problem is that there were various transcriptions made of this inscription that was on a building that no longer exists. So the issue then becomes, you know, was it copied down correctly? And of course, because in the middle of the 19th century, people were looking for Christians in Pompeii, was there a bit of wish fulfillment going on? I I think the latest consensus probably it is authentic, but hard to know. And again, this will confirm Dominic's darkest suspicions.
just when you think that you've
got a really clinching piece of evidence, it kind of slips through your fingers.
There's a crucifix in Herculaneum on the wall. There's the shape of a crucifix,
and people got extremely
excited about this, and it ends up it's probably just a fixture for a shelf. So
it's like gear fitting.
You can't explain these things away. But the same is true for Jews. I've been asked if there are lots of Jews in Pompeii, and you know, we don't really have much evidence, but we know they're in Rome, but whether they're in Pompeii, hard to tell.
But we do have that Indian goddess.
Let's cling
to that. Well, indeed. Sophie, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Very, very exciting. After Stephen Fry, you are our first guest. So, very, very much.
He was a great warm-up act. Thanks.
Thank you, Sophie. That was fascinating.
No, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay. We'll be back next week on my show, and my special guest, Dom Sandbrook, will be with me as well. So we'll see you then.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.